The Dr. Peter Bragan Hour, Mondays at 5 p.m. on the Progressive Radio Network.
Are you ready for the conscience of psychiatry? It's the Dr. Peter Bragan Hour, with guests and callers seeking the truth about psychiatry and psychotherapy, and how you can make the most of your own life, right here on the Progressive Radio Network.
And this is Dr. Peter Bragan. Welcome to another hour with me. My guest today is a most interesting and exciting man. His name is Dr. Charles Whitfield. He's a psychotherapist, he's a physician, and he has a private practice in Atlanta, Georgia. Been a consultant to the CDC, been an instructor at Rutgers University. He's on the editorial boards of journals, national TV, and a number of years back, he wrote a book that sold 1.5 million copies. It's called Healing the Child Within. And he's got additional books, The Truth About Depression, The Truth About Mental Illness. And he's got a brand new book coming out soon that I'll let him tell you about. Now, Charles and I have had totally separate paths over the years and only really got to start communicating with each other within the last year. And yet we have come to extraordinarily similar conclusions about the failure of psychiatric diagnosis, the failure of psychiatric drugs, the needs for more empathic, caring approaches to human beings. So let me introduce you now and bring him on. Charles, welcome aboard.
Thank you, Peter.
It's a pleasure to have you on the show. Would you like to tell folks a little bit about how you got started in this direction that you have eventually taken and tell us a little bit about your philosophy? Take 5 or 6 minutes.
Well, I started out in general medicine, and I'm board certified in internal medicine and then in hematology and oncology, which I practiced up until the late 70s, and then in the but as I was practicing, I noticed that not only in our residency training was alcoholism and other addictions common among our patients, but that probably 4 out of 5 of the patients that we learned medicine on were alcoholics. And then nobody knew what to do to help them, really, at least not in the field of medicine. And then I looked into it and found that all you had to do was to be sincere about helping them get to an AA meeting and to stop drinking and to come back and see you in follow-up. And it worked. And it was remarkable, and nobody in medical school or residency training had ever taught me any of that. And then I started looking at the families of alcoholics and saw what trauma they had been subjected to, and then their adult children who had grown up in these families. Over the years, I gradually transitioned into practicing really what used to be psychiatry, but what today is not psychiatry, of course, because today psychiatry is giving drugs, which I used to do in medicine. So basically, now I'm doing what psychiatrists used to do. And psychiatrists are now doing what I used to do, which is to drug people. And I, as I was learning in the late 70s and early 80s about the effect of not just alcoholism, but but of dysfunction and of trouble in the family and of trauma all around, and of child abuse and neglect. I just started observing in my research, in my teaching, and with my patients what was really happening. And basically they were these troubled, crazy families were murdering the souls of their children and each other. And to survive, what they had to do was to go into hiding, those souls, those that I call the real self or the child within. The child within goes into hiding to survive. It's a survival mechanism in an environment where the child, the person, can't be real and can't express love and receive love in a healthy way. So as I started putting things together more and more, I came to the conclusion that trauma was a major problem in causing psychiatric illness and medical illness. And in 1984 and 5, I wrote Healing the Child Within, and didn't expect it to sell. I wrote it for my patients as a kind of educational effort, what has been called bibliotherapy, and gave it to a publisher, and then started selling. And it sold more and more, and as you said, it's sold around 1.5 million now, mostly by word of mouth. And basically what it is it's Trauma Recovery 101.
Now, Charles, and you're listening to Dr. Charles Whitfield on the Dr. Peter Bregan Hour. Charles, you're using the term trauma in a broader sense than I think most of the folks are used to, who are thinking of it as like a bash in the head or a terribly frightening experience.
Correct.
Talk about your broader view of the kind of trauma that children are exposed to, that you've described as a kind of murder of the soul, and how the child goes into hiding. Because I think you and I agree that this happens to all children to some degree. It's just a lot worse for some folks. And so anyone can experience some assault on their soul growing up. Perhaps you could talk about that and talk about what you mean by that overall concept of trauma.
Yeah, well, this is repeated trauma. This is not a one-time bad automobile accident or the like. This is when the child is, and the most common one is psychological and emotional abuse. It's universal among all the abuses, including child neglect. And some examples would be teasing. And I'm talking not just talking about lightweight teasing. I'm talking about where the child is shamed, and the child is judged, threatened, compared to other children in an unhealthy way. They're invalidated, and at times they even feel terrorized. And the opposite, of course, of that is unconditional love and support and validation and attention and recognition, which kids want, you know, all the time. They're just starving for this. And so this would be what kids want and get in a healthy family. So nearly all all of the abuse and neglect is going to involve psychological and emotional abuse. Then there's physical abuse, which makes probably of all the abuses, maximum around 12% would be severe physical abuse, where you can see evidence of it as you may be examining the child.
Now, do you mean 12% of children in general or 12% of the abused folks we get to see?
12% of abuse is of 12% of physical abuse is severe, where it could be burns or bruises or welts or where you can look at at the kid, look at the skin, and see it. And this involves hits, slaps, punches, push, kicked, bruised, burned, and even choked sometimes. And of course the healthy side of that would be appropriate touch, hugs, caresses, that are, again, this is the healthy things that kids need. And then there's sexual abuse, which is, happens in from 10 to 30% of kids. And, there's two kinds of sexual abuse. Covert, which is more common, including things like sexual jokes, inappropriate nudity exposing to the kids, or preoccupation with sexual content. And then there's overt sexual abuse, where there's inappropriate touching, trying to sexually stimulate the child, and then, of course, penetration. And then it goes with that. Nearly always, the overt, this touching kind, is threatening. That if you tell about what I just did, or they usually say it, what we just did, something bad's going to happen to somebody else in the family or to whoever else they want to threaten, or even to the child. Something bad will happen if you tell. Of course, that's because it's a crime. And then child neglect, at least 25% of child abuse involves neglect. And that's where there's not enough food, not enough clothing, not enough education, medical care. Usually most kids get food, shelter, and clothing, though, but it's the... it's the safety, protection from other traumas that's involved here too. Like I've seen countless families where there was, for example, sexual abuse or physical abuse, where the other parent who was not doing the abusing simply witnessed it and did not intervene and protect the child.
Yes, in my experience, Charles, that's often as devastating or more devastating than the perpetrator, that the mother frequently stood by and did nothing, maybe even encouraged it, but certainly stood by and did nothing, and then brushed it off when the child goes to the parent and says, Mommy, Daddy did something, or Uncle did something, or Grandpa, or Big Brother,
yeah,
and Mom brushes it off.
Yep, exactly right.
Charles, let's talk some about the connection between this and what we see in psychiatry with people getting labeled bipolar, clinical depression, anxiety disorder, OCD, and children getting all these various labels, including now this great extension of the autism spectrum disorders and ADHD. Are you with me in feeling that just about everything we see that we're labeling is actually got behind it a real-life story, and it's the story we should be paying attention to?
Oh, exactly. In my two books, The Truth About Depression and The Truth About Mental Illness, kind of a pair, I studied a ton of peer-reviewed and published studies, and that shows overwhelmingly that most what we call mental illness today is trauma based. But the problem is that a number of authorities around the world, from psychiatry and even psychology are covering this up and instead giving drugs that not only don't work well, but often make the person worse.
Yeah, I think ultimately the drugs always make the person worse because they give the wrong message at the least. They give the message that this isn't a psychological, spiritual response of a normal person to unusual stresses growing up. Rather, this is something in your brain and you need to take a drug. So the very message is immoral. It distracts from the fundamental issues of overcoming what we've been through. And then, of course, they all long-term, as you well know, and you and I have talked about, they all long-term produce increasing disabilities in the people who take them. What do you think are the key elements for people surmounting, transcending, whatever language you would use, and what language would you use, their abusive inheritance from childhood to grow into strong, ethical, loving human beings?
Well, the first thing is to begin to name what has really happened, and to make a link between their trauma and their current situation. So, today the most common one is bipolar, and everybody thinks they're bipolar, and of course they've been told by countless people that they are, and that here you take these drugs. So make the connection, begin to make the connection, and find a person who can assist you in that, who is trained in giving the right kind of psychotherapy or counseling. So that's one route. The other thing you can do is to go to a 12-step meeting. And the 12-step meeting here would be Adult Children of Alcoholics, or Codependence Anonymous, or Emotions Anonymous. And then, of course, Al-Anon is always available in just about every community. But, I've talked about 10 recovery principles in my new book. My new book is called Not Crazy. And the subtitle is You May Not Be Mentally Ill.
When does that come out, Charles?
That will be out probably either later this week or next week. It'll certainly be out in before Christmas.
And how do people get it?
They can get it by going to Amazon. Probably one quick way to get it. They could write me at cbwhit.com. And then make an order there. There's a way to contact me. What I call the 10 recovery principles is first to discover and practice being our real self, which I've also called the child within. And to differentiate that from the false self, which has also been called the ego. And then number two, identify our healthy human needs and practice these needs, getting needs met with safe and supportive people. And then to identify, re-experience, and grieve the pain of our ungrieved losses, hurts, or traumas, again in the presence of safe and supportive people. This whole process has to be done with safe and supportive people. Number four, identify and work through our core recovery issues, from needing to be in control, all or none thinking and behaving, high tolerance for inappropriate behavior, and on and on. And then start to get some healthy boundaries, learn about healthy boundaries and limits. I've got a book called Boundaries and Relationships that's available from from Amazon and many bookstores. And then learning to identify and work through day-to-day conflicts and learning to tolerate emotional pain. And then being patient and persistent in getting help and working through all of our issues and our pain.
Well, I love your list. Again, it's astonishing to me how on rather separate trails we've come to such a similar place. I also emphasize, as I'm sure you do too, the issue of responsibility, that you have to get determined to leave the stress and trauma ultimately behind after you've identified them, learned about them, taken protective steps, and so on. Then you need to be able to take responsibility and say, I'm going to live my own life. I'm going to live by the principles of responsibility and self-determination, liberty, love, the basic principles of life. Any thoughts on that, Charles, on the whole issue of responsibility and where that fits in?
Yeah, we're taking responsibility for getting the job done in the healing process. Yeah, I mean, nobody's going to do it for us. So, I mean, this personal responsibility is a key to a successful life in all areas. And that includes our recovery from these effects of trauma.
Yeah, I have found as a therapist and also just in my general life experience that you can predict what area of life a person is successful in by finding out what they feel they can take responsibility for. So a man who takes responsibility for his professional life or a woman's going to be successful in that area. But if they feel, heck, you can't really take responsibility in your marriage life, they're going to fail in that area. So literally, success begins with the determination that you're going to make it come out the best way you possibly can without any excuses or rationalizations. But at the same time, you want to know what you've been through. You want to acknowledge what you've been through. As you say, you want to identify where it starts and how it's affected you and led to you ending up with one of these cookie-cutter diagnoses that doesn't really tell your story. Charles, you're in private practice in Atlanta?
Right. I'm in private practice with my wife, Barbara. We have specializing in working with people with addictions and adults who were abused as kids. And we have two therapy groups every week, about 5 to 7 members in each group. And I've been doing group therapy. I started learning it in the late 70s, and I've been doing it probably since my first formal therapy group was in 1978 in Baltimore, Maryland, where I stayed until about 1995. So we just get mostly word of mouth referrals.
Do you also do individual counseling?
Yes.
And
yes,
family counseling?
Yeah, we do individual. Sometimes we do couples. And occasionally we'll do family work. Of course, it's all family work in a way, but the rest of the family's not there when we do one-to-one.
I love doing couples work because then I can help the folks help each other. But I guess you get that also through doing group work.
Yes. Yeah, so what I've written about in this new book, Not Crazy, in the next to last chapter about the healing process, is what I call 5 recovery aids. And the first one is therapy or counseling, which could be individual or group therapy or both. And the second recovery aid is 12-step fellowship work that I've already referred to. And then bibliotherapy, reading accurate and selected recovery information. And then putting together a personal recovery plan, making our own recovery plan with the assistance of our therapist. Of course, I've described in my book, especially in my book called A Gift to Myself, which is the workbook for healing the child within, how to make your own recovery plan. And then the fifth recovery aid is no psychiatric drugs. Don't use any of these drugs, because the people that I've seen over the years that have been the most successful in their healing have not used these toxic drugs.
Thank you for your courage and your bravery. When did you come to the realization that psychiatric drugs were not the answer? Was it way, way back?
It wasn't until, I already knew it in the addiction field, because back then, in the 70s, I was noticing the benzodiazepines, you know, the Valium family of sedatives, were not really helping people much. I mean, it just kind of subdued them. And so I've known that since the 70s. Although these drugs are wonderful for acute emergencies and for, you know, situations pre-surgery and after a heart attack and certain other situations where they're very helpful, you know, treating active seizures or... but only for emergency and short-term. But then long-term, these are the most horrendous drugs for people to stop, or at least among the most horrendous for people to stop. Of course, I think the antidepressants and antipsychotics are just about it.
But when did you begin to apply the same principles to psychiatry?
I started waking up to it in the mid to late 80s. And by the 90s, I knew it. I knew these drugs were not helping my patients, because I'd seen them be prescribed mostly by other docs, and they'd come to me, and they were either no better or they were worse.
Now, you came to those conclusions without any familiarity with my work. Am I right about that?
Exactly. I didn't know anything about your work until the late 90s.
Yeah. Yeah, we really did just come to these similar conclusions, and I think it's the truth. I think that the simple truth is that psychological and spiritual anguish, which results from the deepest of it, from family issues and family stressors, but also just from life. Life is tough. That the answers to those problems are psychological and spiritual, and ultimately we help each other through those issues, through counseling, through family life, through 12-step programs, and that psychoactive substances just simply are not the answer. And it's such a wonderful thing to have met you at this stage in our careers and to discover this parallel. We're going to be taking a break in a couple of minutes, in a minute or so. And when we come back, I want to return again to the themes of helping people, because you are so good at articulating what the human problems are and how they can be helped. And I want to hear about the 12-step programs in particular. So this is the Dr. Peter Bregan Hour, and you're listening to my guest, Charles Whitfield.
You are listening to the Dr. Peter Bregan Hour on the Progressive Radio Network. Stay tuned, stay in touch, and call in with your questions at 888-874-4888. That's 888-874-4888.
Progressive Radio Network, celebrating 5 years of independent news.
Free Freedom News Hour will bring you up to date on the latest news on the financial meltdown.
Begin restoring local communities. It can happen.
We'll be exploring the issues from a freedom-oriented, small government perspective.
I'm Walt Thiessen.
I'm Melinda Pillsbury Foster.
I am Jake Towne.
Join us live Thursday evenings at 6 p.m. Eastern Time on ProgressiveRadioNetwork.com.
Gary Knoll. I've been on radio for 37 years, every day, and I'm pleased that the Progressive Radio Network exists, because this is the one form that brings together some of the most important, probing, creative, and dynamic minds on the planet. Join us each and every day, 24/7, on the Progressive Radio Network, your home for independent thinking.
Hello, I'm Mike Adams, the editor-in-chief and key writer of naturalnews.com and co-founder of the nonprofit site consumerwellness.org. I'll be starting a special segment on the Progressive Radio Network called The Health Ranger with Mike Adams. I'll be interviewing everyone from Dr. Jane Goodall to Suzanne Summers. Find out the latest in natural healing news and easy ways to live a healthier and more holistic lifestyle. So tune in on Saturdays at 6 p.m. Eastern every week on the Progressive Radio Network to hear The Health Ranger with Mike Adams.
Hi, you're listening to Bhavani, and I'd like to welcome you every Wednesday on the Progressive Radio Network to join me for my show called I Eat Green, where every Wednesday we will talk about eating healthy and eating sustainably for our planet. So join me every Wednesday from 5 to 6.
Hi, this is Karen Hartglass, host of It's All About Food on the Progressive Radio Network. Please join me every Wednesday at 3 p.m. when we talk about the power of the fork, how our food choices affect our health, the environment, and the treatment of animals. Learn how a plant-based diet of fruits, vegetables, whole grains, legumes, nuts, and seeds is not only delicious, but gentle on the planet.
You're listening to PRN, Progressive Radio Network.
And this is Dr. Peter Breggin on the Dr. Peter Breggin Hour with my marvelous guest, Charles Whitfield, MD, physician with a broad background in medicine, even in cancer treatment, and who became a therapist and has written wonderful books, including his latest book, Not Crazy. Is that right? Am I remembering the title?
That's right. The first subtitle on the front cover is You May Not Be Mentally Ill, and then the subtitles on the title page inside is Misdiagnosed and Mistreated with Drugs That Don't Work Well or Make You Worse. Important information withheld from you by the drug industry, psychiatry, government, and others.
Wonderful. Now, one of the things I've puzzled over a great deal and that my wife Ginger and I have been thinking about a lot in terms of our new organization, which is the Center for the Study of Empathic Therapy, Education, and Living. You can get to that, to our organization, through empathictherapy.com or empathictherapy.org. And Charles Whitfield, my guest, is on the advisory council. He'll be speaking at our meeting in April 8, 9, and 10, a few months from now. If you've enjoyed listening to Charles today, You can meet him and shake his hand, meet his wife at the annual meeting, along with many marvelous people, including Charles. We now have over 30 people coming from outside North America to the conference, and many from the Far East. So we're going to have a wonderfully interesting group at the Empathic Therapy Conference in April. And one of the things that we all keep puzzling about is how to get an affordable approach to helping human beings outside the medical psychiatric model. And you have been applying the principles of the 12-step programs to a broad range of issues and problems, I suspect to really all the problems that we currently treat as psychiatric or psychological problems. In my own practice, I find myself completely consistent with the 12 steps, but I don't particularly mention them or use them unless my client or patient is involved in a 12-step program. Talk some about the application of the 12 steps, maybe tell folks a little bit about them, to life in general and to healing spiritual crises and difficulties in general.
Well, the 12 steps, to me, are the most economic wisdom that I have ever seen anywhere written. The only thing close to it might be the Declaration of Independence. But 12 steps are only 214 words. You know how small that is. And the first step is we admitted we were powerless over, and then you fill in the blank. For alcoholics, of course, it's alcohol. So we admitted we were powerless over, fill in the blank, that our lives had become unmanageable. And the second step is came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. And the third, which makes up the beginning of the first major part of the 12 steps, is made a decision to turn our will and our lives over to the care of God as we understood God. Now, the key word here is care of, because we're not turning our lives over to God. We're turning it over to the care of God. And so admitting powerlessness and then believing, coming to believe that something greater than ourselves could help us, and then making a decision to turn our pain over to the care of God is the first major part of the 12-step program.
Go on and talk some more about them, Charles. Go ahead. You're listening to Charles Whitfield. This is Dr. Peter Bregan. Tell us some more about the 12 steps.
Well, the next group is steps 4 through 9. Step 4 is made a searching and fearless moral inventory of ourselves. What I see happening so often in dysfunctional and painful relationships is that, let's just say, take it for a particular couple, let's say a married or not a married couple, but after they're together long enough, they start taking each other's inventory. And in the 12 steps, step 4 is made a searching and fearless moral inventory of ourselves. And to do that step, we do it ourselves with the assistance of our sponsor, or we could do it with our therapist, but not our spouse, not our partner, not somebody who's supposed to be, on our side. In this particular relationship that we have committed to, that instead turn against us so often and take our inventories. So then an inventory is really what our strengths are and our weaknesses. And of course, they focus on the weaknesses and then later too often forget that in a moral inventory would include strengths too.
You know, it's so interesting, Charles. By the way, I just think this is a marvelous presentation. We can't do justice to it in the 1 hour, and of course I'm going to have you back, and of course you're going to be at our meeting of the empathictherapy.org group in April. One of the things that stymies so many of my clients, my patients, is that they have felt so injured by their partner that they just can't let go of what you're calling taking their inventory, reminding them of their crimes, so to speak.
Yeah.
And we think that's a good thing. We feel strong. We feel we've got to do that. We feel righteous. We feel we got to let that other person know. And yet it's actually a huge burden on ourselves to be taking on that godlike critical attitude toward a loved one. It's not good for anybody in the partnership.
Yeah, one of the biggest ways to turn each other off is to take each other's inventory.
Yeah. Well, go on with the steps.
Step
Tell us some
five,
more if you're comfortable
then,
with that.
Then is once we have taken that inventory, admitted to God, to ourselves, and to another human being the exact nature of our wrongs. So this is usually done with a sponsor, meaning the other human being. Of course, to do the inventory, we've told ourselves, and then we've also admitted it to God because we're already in a spiritual program here. And then number six, once we've done that, we were entirely ready to have God remove all these defects of character. Now, these defects of character are usually core issues, what I call core recovery issues, like needing to be in control, all or none thinking and behaving, high tolerance for inappropriate behavior, difficulty giving and receiving love. You know, I put together about 15 of those that I review in my books, starting with Healing the Child Within. So we're entirely ready to have God remove all these defects of character, number six. Number seven is humbly asked God to remove our shortcomings. So four through seven now is kind of a beginning.
Yeah.
Go deep into this whole thing. I mean, we've already gone deep enough to say that our lives were unmanageable in step number one.
Right.
But now we're going even more deep. And here's a key word in step seven. Humbly asked him to remove our shortcomings. See, humility is the key. Because humility is an absolute necessity to make the 12 steps work.
You know, Charles, one of the most important things I feel I did in my own life years back when I was involved in the early stages of being a reformer and I was fighting out in the world and angry all the time and was to realize that I couldn't handle my anger. And I was at the time knew a friend very well who was in the 12-step program, who was working on letting go of things through the 12-step program. And I asked God to take my anger. I said, God, if there's somebody out there that I'm involved in conflict with, whether it's in the family or in my political reform work, somebody needs somebody angry at him, I'd like you to do it because I can't handle it. I can't handle being angry. I'm going to give up my anger to you, God. And, of course, I knew that God wasn't going to go being angry at anybody. That certainly wasn't his task. But I just gave him up my anger. And I returned to that. And it's been a huge relief to me to know that I can't handle being angry and that I work so much better out of a more loving, calm, positive state that's promoting rather than being angry.
Yeah, my definition of humility is the openness and willingness to learn more about self, others, and God.
I love it, Charles. I love what you're saying.
And my wife, Barbara, and I have written a book called The Power of Humility, which takes it into relationships, and how in relationships we so often get into triangles that end up being our downfall. And we have, with two more authors, have put together this staged process of how to rise above these conflicted, painful triangles and to move up toward the direction of spirituality, where things start to open up for us and just work better in our lives.
Now, Charles, obviously, a number of people don't believe in God. Not as big numbers as one might suspect. And I work in a community in Ithaca, New York, that's very secular in many ways. Big university, Cornell is here, and Ithaca College. And, of course, a number of my clients and patients don't believe in God, although I ask them about it. I address it in therapy. Are you working with many people who don't believe in God in your groups? And if so, how do you handle that?
Yeah, well, a lot of them, you know, have been so hurt by their religious experiences. And the ones who have been traumatized, you know, they may have prayed to God for help and they didn't get the help they wanted. So, yeah, a lot of them do. And, you know, I grew up in a conventional kind of a Protestant family, but then I became an atheist myself in my 20s, and I was a big fan of Ayn Rand, who was, you know, a big atheist. But
I'm really laughing, Charles, because our paths are, I won't go into detail here, but our paths are so similar. See, you read Ayn Rand, and it probably seemed incredibly empowering at the time, as it did for me.
And it still is, because now I can look at her work in a different light, because she was politically one of the most right-on writers I had ever seen, and she came out of Russia where she had been, ruled by these dictators and this whole communist regime. And so if anybody's going to know about freedom and learn about freedom, it's going to be somebody like her. But what I noticed about her, and what I noticed about also Madeline Murray O'Hare, who was the head of the American Atheist Movement way back, was that these were two of the most spiritual people I had ever encountered.
Right.
Because they were so into what they were doing, and they didn't... And they weren't trying to preach any particular way. They were just speaking clearly. But then I started to, in my early 30s, I learned to meditate. And after a few years of meditating, I started to wake up and started to get to know God in a real way. And so I'll refer to people who say, do you believe in God? I'll refer them to this interview that was done on the BBC years ago with Carl Jung. The interviewer said to Jung, do you believe in God? And Jung paused. He paused, and it's still on the film this way, probably 20 seconds. And on film, that's a long time.
Very, yes.
And his answer was no. I know God. I don't believe. It's not a case of believing. It's a case of knowing God. And that's what I found. I mean, I was trying to believe in God when I was a kid and, you know, in my early life. But then I had to leave God, leave what I thought God was, before I could get to know God in person.
This is Charles Whitfield that my audience has the privilege and honor of listening to. Charles Whitfield, physician and therapist. And this is Peter Bregan. Charles, we have about 10 minutes left. Talk some more about applying the principles of 12 steps to helping people across the spectrum of what we call psychiatric disorders. Have you seen it work? How much is it going on? How can we go about increasing its availability?
Yeah, well, I think certainly for basic chemical addictions, I think AA and Narcotics Anonymous are the two main ones. And so this is the introduction to the 12 steps that I think all of those kind of people can benefit from. But then for the families, Al-Anon certainly is going to be key. And I've even referred some people to Al-Anon who really were not in families, not in alcoholic families, but they were just in a dysfunctional family, or they had a so-called mentally ill family member, and they benefited. They benefited because Al-Anon has these same 12 steps, and it's people telling their stories. And, of course, the stories told at 12-step meetings are nearly always in three parts: what we were like, what happened, and what we're like now. So the what we were like is, you know, how I kind of went downhill and got worse and worse in whatever part of my life it was. And I lost my job, my family, my this, that, my freedom. And then what happened, I lost all of that and I hit a bottom. And then I found the 12 steps.
Now, what about Emotions Anonymous? You mentioned that. How effective is it? How much experience do you have with just applying these principles to anyone who might come into a psychotherapist or a psychiatrist's office?
Well, Emotions Anonymous, of course, is that they're powerless over their emotions, over their, you know, painful feelings, and their life had become unmanageable, and they're trying to find out what they are and just kind of share their story. So it's the same story in these three parts. It's just in one meeting it will be alcohol or drugs, and the other one will be having a crazy family member, and the other one might be having these emotions that are running their life.
Now, are there Emotions Anonymous in most cities in America?
No. They're usually in bigger cities. You have to just, you know, go online and to the website. Just type in Emotions Anonymous on your search, and then type in your zip code and see if there are any meetings in your area.
I gotcha. Do you think that the 12 steps are as effective for helping everyone? You haven't quite answered that. Are you unsure or cautious about that? You seem firmer when you're talking about the chemical dependencies. Do you think that they have the same power with all people who are struggling with psychological, spiritual suffering and helplessness?
Yeah, I think adult children of alcoholics, which is really adult children of trauma, is a group that started in the late 70s. In Manhattan and just spread across the country and now in parts of the world. But it now has a big book, like the AA's big book, which is their main book. ACA has its big book, and you can go to, I think it's adultchildren.org, or you can just do a search engine for adult children of alcoholics. And see, it's a thick, beautiful, and a well-written book. And then they have a workbook. So they are really sophisticated. And then Codependence Anonymous has back in the 80s, they put together their big book. And both books have numerous stories, as do the AA.
So these are some of the places people can go. Codependence Anonymous.
Yes.
Emotions Anonymous, Adult Children of Alcoholics Anonymous.
Yes.
Anyone else, any other group you want to mention?
Well, Overeaters Anonymous, of course, and you know, there are like over 100 12-step groups that have developed over these decades.
Yeah. Do you have any summary thoughts, or what are your summary thoughts? We have 5 minutes. Take 2 or 3 minutes and kind of tell folks what we all really need to do to grow and develop and take on this difficult task of living. I'll put you on the spot, Charles.
Yeah, well, you know, it's hard to, I mean, everybody's got their own path, but I would just refer to the 11th step of the 12 steps, which is the longest of the steps. It says, thought through prayer and meditation to improve our conscious contact with God. Praying only for knowledge of God's will for us and the power to carry that out. So this one, I think, is among the more powerful of the 12 steps. Prayer and meditation, if we can do those every day, that's a big aid to our well-being. And we're praying only for the knowledge of God's will for us and the power to carry that out.
So this Charles, mention your book one last time, and then we'll be finishing up.
Okay, yeah. Well, my new book that can be ordered from Amazon in a week or so is called Not Crazy, You May Not Be Mentally Ill, and the subtitles are Misdiagnosed and Mistreated with Drugs That Don't Work Well or Make You Worse, Important Information Withheld from You by the Drug Industry, Psychiatry, Government, and Others.
You have been listening to my dear friend and colleague, Dr. Charles Whitfield, a therapist in practice with his wife in Atlanta, Georgia. You can easily find him on the web. He's a well-known individual in the world, the author of a number of books. And I hope that you'll want to meet him, because a good, easy way to meet him is April 8th, 9th, and 10th, when he and his wife will be at our annual Empathic Therapy Conference. You can learn all about the conference and learn about the people who are going to be speaking there, including Dr. Whitfield, by going to empathictherapy.org. All of us who participate in the conference and in the Empathic Therapy Center are volunteers. We're not doing this for money, and certainly there's not a lot of power and glory. We're doing this, and I think I can speak for Charles about this too, because we really do want to get out the word. And the word is that psychological and spiritual approaches to life are ultimately the only genuine healing approach. Not psychiatric diagnoses, not drugs, but caring relationships with each other and with God. This is Dr. Peter Breggin saying goodbye again.
You've been listening to the Dr. Peter Breggin Hour with a new live show every Monday evening at 5 p.m. East Coast time on the Progressive Radio Network, where each show is archived for your convenience. You can learn more about Dr. Breggin and his lifelong reform work on www.breggin.com. That's B-R-E-G-G-I-N.com.